Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello there. Welcome to today's New Books in Education, one of the podcast channels in New Books Network. This is Pengfei Zhao, your host for today's program, speaking to you from Bloomington, Indiana. Before I introduce today's guest, let me ask you a question first. How many of you love stories? I do. From the beautifully illustrated children's book to the sophisticated contemporary novels. They are very important thought food for me. Good stories stay for a long time in my mind. In my free time, I like to ponder over them, share them, sometimes even write about them. But using stories to do social research? Or present research findings in the form of stories? These ideas probably are still too new for many of us. Today, I will be talking with an expert of stories. Meanwhile, she's also a well-established researcher who uses stories to produce solid social research. Dr. Junghee Kim from Texas Tech University. We will be talking about her new book, Understanding Narrative Inquiry, the Crafting and Analysis of Stories as Research, published by Sage Press in 2016. Now, I will refrain from a lengthy introduction of the book, but let Junghee lead us to her world of stories. Hello, Junghee. Welcome to New Books in Education.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, I'm very excited to talk with you about your wonderful book, Understanding Narrative Inquiry. But before we dive into the book, tell us some stories. Stories about what led you to narrative inquiry and to this book.
Do you want a long story or a short story?
maybe... I don't know. I mean,
medium-sized story.
yes, medium-sized story is fine.
Well, you know, I think I have to say that it was out of fluke that I got into narrative inquiry, because if I did not meet my dissertation advisor Tom Brown, I would not have gotten into narrative inquiry. I was a doctoral student. Actually, Dr. Brown was not my original advisor, but at the beginning of my doctoral study, I went to see him in his office and asked him to be my dissertation advisor, but he rejected me. It's because he had too many students at the time. And so
he's very popular.
Yeah. Actually, he did not admit more than 5 students. So he had 5, and I had to wait until one of his students graduated. So I had to wait for 2 years. And finally, actually, it happened after I took his narrative inquiry class. And I just fell in love with it. And I just thought that, okay, I'm going to use this methodology no matter what. And but he was not my advisor, but I thought that I really need to have him on my committee so that I could learn more from him, because I just took one class on narrative inquiry, and there was much more to learn about it. So the field is like vast. So I went to see him again and see if there's any spot. Luckily, he said, yes, I do have one spot for you, so you can be my strength. So from then on, my life as a Dr. Strength really began to, I guess, blossom, because I just loved working with him and visited with him and asking questions about narrative, more articles to read. He was sharing with me, and I think that's pretty much how I got into narrative inquiry. But but how I got into narrative inquiry and writing this book was that, although I was engaged in narrative inquiry, there's no one or two specifically, you know, discussing narrative inquiry as a way to guide students and faculty who are interested in narrative. I felt like narrative inquiry was all over, and I wanted to introduce some, like I had a lot of students asking me questions. Okay, Dr. Kim, what book should I read? I'm interested in narrative inquiry. What book should I read? What article should I read? Then I really did not have an answer for it. And I felt like, okay, I mean, what is it? What is narrative inquiry? I mean, it's so hard to define, and there are so many resources that I could pull from. There's one particular book or article that I could just, you know, recommend. So I just, I felt a need to write a book on narrative. And here I am. It took me 3 years, but, you know, that's pretty much the story of how I got into writing this book.
So at the time when you started to use narrative inquiry, what did the field look like? You just mentioned there was no one book, like comprehensive book, that you can point it to for your students to give an introduction for the method or the methodology. What was the field look like? What did the field look like at that time?
You know, it was about early 2000s when I got into this methodology. And I have to admit that it was hard to find a journal that would accept this kind of storytelling methodology, because there was a lot of bias and prejudice against storytelling. A lot of academics believe that storytelling is not academic enough, it's not theoretical enough, therefore we are not going to accept any kind of this article or, you know, manuscript that employs narrative inquiry. And I, at the beginning of my academic career as an assistant professor, I received a lot of rejections. And I suddenly thought about, you know, I felt a kind of crisis where I thought, oh my gosh, what did I do? Why did I choose narrative inquiry? Because it's not popular. It's not really well accepted by the by the academic community, I'm not going to, you know, be able to succeed as a scholar and researcher if I continue to use narrative inquiry. And so I had some kind of panic moment in early 2000. But looking back, I feel like it was not the methodology that rejected my manuscript. My manuscript was not strong enough anyway. Whether it used narrative, it was not because I used narrative inquiry, but I did not make it strong enough to be worthy of publication, because after rejections, I was able to go back to those rejected manuscripts, and I figured out ways to strengthen the discussion section and conclusion by drawing upon the literature and theories. So it did not matter whether I used narrative inquiry. It was the matter of making my work, narrative inquiry work, scholarly and theoretical enough. Then people liked it, and I started getting acceptances. So to make the long story short, the field in 2000, a narrative inquiry field, was not that as popular as now. But now I feel like when I say narrative inquiry, people seem to understand what it is, and they like it, and they are excited about it. So I see the differences that I feel from the field before, like around the early 2000s, and now, you know, close to 2020. So,
So from what you said just now, it sounds like two decades ago, narrative inquiry was still struggling to gain enough recognition in academia. I mean, from academics, right?
Right. Yeah.
But the method is just getting more and more popular in this most recent two decades. Mm-hmm. And you seem to see more recognition from people across different disciplines. So who are using narrative inquiry now? Like what kind of scholars are using narrative inquiry? I'm asking because it is such an interdisciplinary method, and I'm trying to get a sense of like who are from what scholars from what kind of disciplines are using it.
You know, surprisingly, because I'm in education, I thought that only educational researchers are using narrative inquiry, but as I talk to more people in other disciplines, such as economy or counseling or sociology, all these fields in social sciences, they are very much interested in narrative inquiry and they use it. Even in the arts, art community, they talk about visual storytelling, visual narratives. You know, how they use narrative to better understand or to better communicate their artwork. So narrative is actually everywhere. And I see the connections all the time between narrative and what we do as a researcher or as a normal, person. Narrative is how we think and how we live. So I have to say that this narrative inquiry is kind of embedded in everyday life.
And you think people like starting our everyday life from different perspectives are all interested in narrative inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it surprised me. You told me people from economics, economists are also using narrative inquiry.
Right. And law, people in law use narrative inquiry. And medicine and nursing, the field of nursing, narrative inquiry is very popular in their field as well.
Wow.
Any field that involves human beings, that involves people, they use narrative.
Wow, interesting. So that means you really have a vast audience, like you have a very wide readership for your book.
I don't know about that. I wish.
We know that the book won the 2017 Outstanding Publication Award from AERA's Narrative Research Special Interest Group. So it really said something about the quality of the book, I would say. And
Thank you.
You are so welcome. And I think the book really pushes the field to move forward significantly. With that said, I would like to direct our conversation to the book itself.
Sure.
And actually, I was planning to ask you about what's your definition of narrative inquiry. But then I read this paragraph in the preface of the book. Do you mind if I just read it out here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. So you write a paragraph about people ask me what narrative inquiry is, and ironically, I found this simple question difficult to answer because A, there are so many narrative researchers in different disciplines who have adopted narrative theory and method in different ways. B, the narrative field is changing and evolving. And C, narrative inquiry attempts to embrace diversity in methods, avoiding association with only one of the many currently in use. So what is your approach to narrative inquiry in this book? If the task of defining narrative inquiry is so insurmountable?
Well, I have to keep reminding myself of what narrative inquiry is, that is totally and closely related to stories. So I have to, you know, if you ask me what is the definition of narrative inquiry, I have to say it's a storytelling methodology. Because I have observed that a lot of people, they say they are doing narrative inquiry, but when I look at their work, there's no story in that inquiry process. So I keep reminding myself and my students, if they say they want to be engaged in narrative inquiry, I have to say that, well, then you have to tell stories. And when you approach narrative inquiry, you have to approach it from the narrative perspective. You have to write narratively. You have to think narratively. But I see some kind of disconnect between their approach to narrative and their actual embodiment of narrative or lack thereof. So my approach to narrative inquiry is how can I tell a story that is really compelling, that is really approachable, that is so that brings out a lot of resonance among readers. So that is my approach. But then when we say storytelling, again, as I said before, some people in academia may think that narrative as a storytelling methodology is not academic or scholarly enough. So we really have to juggle the balance between scholarly work, narrative inquiry as a scholarly work, and narrative inquiry as an artistic work. We really need to merge the scholarly approach and artistic approach when we do narrative. So that's my approach.
Well, would you like to say a little bit more about how to make the merge happen? It sounds very it sounds a very good approach, but it may help the audience to understand better if you can give us, say, an example, for example.
So in my book, I think I talk about the notion of aesthetic play, where you have to be serious and playful at the same time. So when I say serious, you really need to be able to theorize what you are working on, your research topic, your research data that you have. And then at the same time, you really have to be playful with ideas of how to make sense of the data that you have, and how you can design and create some meaningful representation of the data that you have so that readers or, you know, audience who read your work may find your work really like relevant to what they do and have some resonance with their thinking. So I have to say that merging or marriage between scholarly work and artistic work or expression is critical in doing narrative inquiry, because we cannot write a boring story based on our research data. It has to be engaging, it has to be interesting, it has to be appealing, it has to be compelling to the reader. That's how we make our work, narrative work, different from other, more traditional quality research.
So what kind of data do you use, for example? Like, do you use some conventionally a version of data, like interviews, observations? What are some of the data do you and other narrative inquirers use?
The approach to data collection is not different from what traditional quality researchers may use. So, you know, interview is the main source of data collection for narrative inquiry, because but the way to conduct an interview would be different for narrative inquirers from the traditional way of doing an interview, because I would say that, you know, interviews, there are many sorts of different interviews, but if you are doing a narrative inquiry, then you have to do a kind of more narrative interviews, like life story interviews, life history interviews, where you could elicit lengthy stories from your participants. Another data source would be, you know, collecting visuals like photos or other artifacts, documents. So we use all kinds of traditional ways of collecting data for qualitative research, but then how to elicit the story from the data would require some narrative thinking and some techniques and some judgment from the researcher.
Well, interesting. Then there is this this issue of representing the data. Mm-hmm. And you mm-hmm. think that part is more unique for narrative inquiry. Is that what you mean just now?
Right, yeah, yeah. You know, the data representation. So after collecting data, all qualitative researchers and quantitative researchers alike, they have to figure out ways to represent their data so that it is readable, it is approachable, right? So it has to be placed on a paper. So then how do we represent the data that we have? Again, that requires your creativity and imagination. Also, we have to think about how to honor the voices of our storytellers, our participants. How do we honor their voices, and without violating their integrity, how do we represent data in our work? That is kind of, that requires some ethical decision, and is something that we really have to think about seriously and then playfully at the same time.
Then going back to this balance you just talked about, this balance between aesthetic play and serious academic research. Mm-hmm. So I have a question about, you know, after you have this story, after you tell this story, then how do you theorize the story? Like, I think that part leans toward the serious academic stuff, that part, that aspect. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, sometimes my advisor, Dr. Brown, when I took his class, he always asked this question, like, can a story stand on its own? Do we need to theorize the story? And why, right? So we had to struggle with that idea. If we really believe that a story is so important, and that's how we make sense of, you know, our research phenomenon, then why do we you know, feel compelled to theorize those stories? So that was something that we had to kind of grapple with. So our kind of sort of conclusion of that conversation was that if a story is good enough, we don't need any theorizing. The story,
oh, really?
Real good story is like, should be able to stand on its own. And when we finish the readers, when the readers finish the story, they don't feel obliged to read more. It's like after reading the story, it's like they have this kind of aha moment. And they have to stop and pause and think, oh my gosh, what did I just read? This is just amazing. So when you read a good story, like fiction or literary story, we don't feel that the story needs to be theorized. So if a narrative inquirer writes a story and that is good enough, then I guess we don't need to theorize it. But then there is a dilemma that, as you mentioned, you know, as like us being in academia, we need to be able to theorize what we just wrote. That's how we make it publishable. So that's something that we have to grapple with, and I still don't have a really good solution to it. But when I advise my doctoral students, I always say that, you know, you really need to theorize the story. That's how we can make a difference in the academia without theorization. But then that theorization has to be drawn upon the literature. Without that theorization, you are not going to make it. It's because I think that's why I cannot call myself a writer or a fiction writer. I'm not in the College of Liberal Arts. I'm in the College of Education, and I myself view myself as an education researcher. So, although I feel like I'm borrowing this literary methodology to understand the education phenomenon that I'm interested in, but it doesn't mean that I'm a pure writer or a fiction writer. I'm an education researcher. So I think that, but someday my goal is to write a story that can stand on its own, like real compelling story.
So you have just covered so many interesting points. And I want to, let me see. I have two questions. Mm-hmm. First question is about this story standing on its own. Mm-hmm. I want you to give us an example of such a story. I mean, a story that from your point of view, standing on its own, maybe that one really gave you an aha moment so that our audience will know what kind of like standard you are holding there.
One of the examples that we used in our class with Dr. Braun was Jonathan Kozol's work, Children in America. So he does ethnographic study. He doesn't call himself a researcher, right? He's a journalist, and he goes out these schools that are run down and show us what it is like to be in a school that is totally unsupported, that is school for especially for people of people of color. So, but then Jonathan Kozol never theorizes his story. But then when we read his work, it's like it gives us aha moments about what it's like to be in such a school. Another story that I really admire is Pat Conroy's The Water is Wide. It's a story about his experience of being a teacher in an island. He did a stint in this island of being a teacher for a year, and he documents all kinds of his experiences and his perceptions and all kinds of stories, anecdotes that happened while he's teaching working with students and people living in that island. That book is like so captivating, and but then Pat Conroy is a famous writer, and again he's not a researcher, so there is a distinction between a storyteller or a writer and an educational researcher. And sometimes maybe we should distinguish the differences, but maybe we don't need to. When we become one, that's the kind of direction that I want to go. That would be my goal, where I can be the storyteller and an educational researcher, two people in one. I think that's what I want to go.
So you are really trying to make this merge happen. Like mm-hmm. you are really trying to see yourself fit in these two different shoes, shall I say mm-hmm. that? I mean, yeah. And then we see the distinction between, say, artistic work and just educational research. The boundary is blurring yeah. in narrative inquiry.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of narrative inquiry because, you know, you write something, academic stuff, and nobody reads it. And what is the point of writing it? So if we can write something that is readable, that is approachable, that can be read by, you know, wide audience, I think we can make a difference, right, with our research. But when nobody reads our work, how can we make a difference?
Well, that's very interesting, but I also want to play this devil's role just to mention that, you know, this very strong tradition of producing objective knowledge in the field of educational research and this very strong emphasis of, you know, you need to create some scientific work instead of some aesthetic work. And mm-hmm. that reminds me of like the conversation we just had about theorization. So mm-hmm. for example, I think in your book, you've introduced many different theories that qualitative inquirers can use in their work. Like you introduced critical theory, critical race theory, feminist methodology, but I just didn't see you mention, say, post-positivism, or maybe critical realism. Did you mention that? I just wonder what is your take on these different theoretical traditions? I mean, in relation to the narrative inquiry work.
Yeah, I think I just briefly talk about how positivism and post-positivism is still well and alive in academia and how narrative inquiry cannot fit into that, you know, that paradigm. But my argument is that it's not either positivistic research or more post-structural or post-modern research, or more critical research. It's not about either or. I think it has to be both, because either methodology or either paradigm has its own merits, and it has own usage for whatever, you know, depending on what kind of topic you have. So I wouldn't exclude any paradigm. However, narrative inquiry, when you use narrative inquiry, is you cannot be in this paradigm where you think black or white, black and white, or you know, this dichotomic way of thinking. It has to embrace some ambiguities, uncertainties, you know, that are real human nature, right? So we cannot rely on positivistic ideas on everything, especially when we try to understand how people make sense of their lives. So positivism or post-positivism is not really main paradigm that narrative inquirers might use, but I have to say that positivism is like is everywhere. We cannot avoid that, and we might place ourselves at disadvantage if we stay away from it. But then, because especially when you try to write a grant proposal, you know, like big federal grant agencies like National Science Foundation, they still want quantitative measurement, positivistic ideas. So if you say, well, I'm going to use narrative inquiry to evaluate a certain program, they are not going to accept that proposal, right? So, but I think as researchers, we really need to find ways to embrace differences and to be able to see where we fit in with our methodology. We cannot violate our philosophical orientations to meet the needs that federal agencies require us to do. So there's a difference, I think, that we need to think about.
So then what is your philosophical approach in doing narrative inquiry?
It could be anything, actually, except for positivistic paradigm. I sometimes mm-hmm. use phenomenology. I mm-hmm. use critical theory. I use, post-structuralism. Like, I use rhizomatic thinking. And currently, I'm very interested in affect theory. So it really depends on what research project you are working on. It really depends on the issues that you are exploring. I think we have to be versatile in using different theories and philosophies.
Oh, then you are really working on a wide range of theories.
Yeah, because I cannot be just one theory. Because, mm-hmm. Depending on, issues, social issues that I want to look at, I could sometimes focus on racial issues. I want to focus on gender issues. I want to focus on some power issues, but everything is kind of critical, right? So it really depends on what the focus is.
Well, that's very interesting. Just now you mentioned this, for example, if you write for grant application, you probably will encounter this expectation from the funding agency about mm-hmm. being evidence-based, for example, or being mm-hmm. Objective, or being mm-hmm. value-neutral. So mm-hmm. have you, in your own work, experienced any pushback?
Yeah, definitely, because I was collaborating with faculty in engineering and the faculty in psychology, psychological sciences. So they are all like about measurement. They are all about quantifying the data. They are all about finding evidence. And here I am talking about stories, talking about quality and qualitative nature in the project that we were working on. When we actually, the original proposal that we were working on did not have this faculty member in psychology. So we did not have, in our proposal, we did not have any kind of measurement, any statistics that we will use to evaluate the project that we were proposing. So our proposal got denied, got rejected. And one of the reviewers' comments was that, you know, how are you going to measure? How are you going to assess, you know, your findings, your results? So actually, after that comment, we had to invite a faculty member in psychology who is really good at assessment or something like that. So, yeah, that's my story.
Yeah, so how do you manage this? I mean, it sounds like you have your own way to overcome it or to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
I think people will be interested in knowing that because sometimes people are working with this maybe marginalized non-mainstream methodologies and they are struggling to, you know, to get more resources to navigate their research careers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, you know, what we can do is embracing the differences. I try to practice that in my work. I as I was working with these people in different fields, what I learned is how to give in instead of insisting, how to insist your value. I think that how I think we have to have a conversation about what it is that we need to do, and depending on what the purpose or objective of our research or our agenda is, we could use different methods. We could work in different paradigms. But I think that's where collaboration is very valuable when we see that when we work out this kind of conflict that exists. Instead of running away from those conflicts, I think we really need to learn from each other and understand and embrace each other's differences.
Well, that's a very interesting perspective. And I'm pretty sure like novice researchers, our junior researchers will learn from your advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so.
And you know, I want to continue our conversation, like specifically pointing to one aspect of the book, which I think is very fascinating and interesting, where you talk about fictionalization.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk about sometimes when representing narrative findings, you can researchers can fictionalize their stories. So what does that mean?
I think that that's, well, if we look at these research processes and writing processes on a continuum, you really want to begin with raw data. And you kind of play with it and try to find ways to better represent the data you have. And, you know, we could work on like, you know, data analysis using trying to find emergent themes, some commonalities among the data. But then you might see that there is a really compelling story within the data. And as you try to represent the story, sometimes you feel that the story is an analogy instead of your findings, because that story has so many, the story really represents the social issues that go on in the society, and using that story as a symbol or analogy, we could bring all the different audiences to together to help them understand what it is that we really need to work on to make a better society, to improve this condition, human condition. So then when you reach that point, that story is not just your participant's story. It becomes everybody's story. Then what is the point of making a like a factual story, right? So sometimes it turns into a fictionalized story. One example is Frank, who wrote a fictionalization of her research about dancers. She's an anthropologist, and she did her research in bars where mm-hmm. you meet people and dance and drink, and actually strippers, actually. So she really did research on the lives of strippers working mm-hmm. for men. First of all, it was important that she fictionalized her story because she didn't want to reveal any of the names, right? She needed to protect the participants. And secondly, the themes that she was seeing over and over was kind of, projected the typical story that we would see in such situations. So it was better for her to fictionalize her research project that took so many years, rather than trying to talk about what the evidence was or not. It was, she reached a point where talking about evidence was kind of meaningless. So I think that's the approach that she used. So you will reach a point where you say that maybe fictionalization is better. It's not because you didn't do any research, but because of that reach data that you have, perhaps sometimes fictionalization makes more sense.
Yeah, so what you said makes me think that sometimes fictions are, what should I say, more real than mm-hmm. the real stories.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that sounds very interesting, but also I feel like this process of creating meaningful stories must be very, it's a long process, and the writing is so challenging. Like mm-hmm. if a novice researcher just starts to learn narrative inquiry, just starts mm-hmm. to craft her own stories, what advice will you give to her?
Read and write. I view my writing process as kind of making a sculpture where I have to craft, I have to make adjustments, I have to work on making it better every day. I will have so many drafts to make my work better. And I would really have my strength focus on the process of writing, how writing is like a part of inquiry, So we really need to practice how to write better. But then to write better, we need to be inspired through readings that we do.
Well, that sounds like it's something really need a lot of time and energy and determination.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and resilience.
Yeah, and resilience.
Don't give up. Yep.
Yeah, and resilience. Yeah, and that's why I feel like I really appreciate that you include a lot of small stories in your book about, mm-hmm. for example, about this student, Brian, and uh-huh. how he created, designed his qualitative project and how he changed his mind, how he eventually created his own stories. But then he decides just to let go of the story to he switched to a different trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so do you have a lot of students feel this kind of, when students feel this kind of frustration, like how do you encourage them? Or how do you, maybe just encourage them to continue this process?
I don't encourage them.
Okay.
It's their choice. A lot of people, some of my students, they choose narrative inquiry because they like it, just like what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And they just think that it would come easy because we are all storytelling animals, so to speak. So they just think that they can write a story, they can tell a story. But then when I look at their work, it is far from what we wanted to see as part of a narrative inquiry project. So I have to say that storytelling or narrative inquiry requires more effort because it kind of takes one more step. Like you would do if you are doing a traditional quality research, like case study, you may not need to worry about how to write a compelling story, and how to theorize the story. So it takes more effort to be a real good narrative inquirer. So if they don't want to do it and they don't see the value in narrative and they want to go to a different route, and I say, okay, sure. But then at the same time, I see a lot of students who are determined to use narrative inquiry, and I just try to guide them to think of their project from narrative perspective, because they cannot work on narrative project when they have these positivistic ideas about what quality research should be like. Right, so I really have to work on their paradigm, their ways of thinking, and I ask them to embody the narrative way of thinking and writing from the very beginning of their process.
Wow, that sounds like you have really put a lot of energy and a lot of efforts into nurturing this narrative nature of your students. Like thinking.
Yeah, I try because you cannot say that you are using narrative inquiry, but then when you see their writing is written in a very dry way. Like, so I kind of ask students to start with their own story, personal story of, why they are here, right? And how they got interested in their research project. Then they begin to own their writing and their research project. So they cannot write any narrative any narrative inquiry project by detaching themselves from the writing process.
Well, I see. Well, that's so interesting. And thank you so much for taking us to this journey of, you know, our touring as the landscape of narrative inquiry. I feel like I've learned a lot from you about how you think narratively, write narratively, mm-hmm. and research narratively today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. And we have taken so much time from you, Zhonghee. Before we wrap up our interview, I just want to ask you what you are working on right now. Like, we will be really happy to have you again. What are you working on right now?
Well, contact me in a couple of years because I'm writing a book on different theories. My chapter 2 of my book is about different philosophical orientations, but I really had limited space to talk about all kinds of theories that are available that we could use. Now I'm kind of expanding that chapter into a book. And I see my students struggling with their theoretical frameworks. That's my next project, actually the current project that I'm working on, writing a book on different theoretical frameworks.
Well, then we hope you can continue enjoying this playful, aesthetic writing experience about very serious theories.
You know what? You really made a good point. That's the struggle that I'm having. You know, how can I write a book on theories that are really heavy, dense topics? How can I make it more aesthetically, right? So that people can be engaged in reading the book. So that's my challenge.
Well, I just feel like you embody this narrative approach. I mean, from your challenge and your approach and how you talk about. Yeah, well, thank you so much. And we surely look forward to having you again after you after you get this book out about
this. Thank you.
Yeah, and we look forward to reading it. And I'm pretty sure that will be a very enjoyable read because you are really working very hard to make it aesthetically beautiful, stylish. Oh.
Yeah, thank you. I will try. I will do my best.
Well, thank you for being with us today, Zhonghee.
Thank you, Peng Fai. Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.